Girl Bummer. My name is Nikki Strong, playing you the pop music.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Gregory Stockel, and John Russell. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Thailand's government recently provided new guidance on how the official name of the capital, Bangkok, would be used internationally. The guidance, however, caused some confusion. Some people thought it meant that English speakers would need to start calling Bangkok by its longer local name, Krontep Mahanakhon. But Thailand's Royal Society recently explained that the new guidance did not mean that people should stop calling the capital Bangkok. The Royal Society is responsible for creating academic and language guidelines for the country. In its recent guidance, the agency said the capital would now be officially known internationally as Krontep Mahanakhon, Bangkok. This was a change from the old guidance, which described the capital as Krontep Mahanakhon, Bangkok. As people tried to understand the meaning of the new guidance, many saw the use of parentheses around Bangkok as a sign that the short form may no longer be welcomed like before. The short name for the capital means Great City of Angels in Thai. When speaking, most Thais shorten that name to Krontep. Some language experts wondered if the new guidance would lead to difficulties for people not aware of the capital's longer official name. As the issue gained attention in Thailand, the Royal Society released a statement on Facebook explaining that its new guidance simply represented a stylistic change. Writing the capital city's official name with the Roman alphabet can be done both as Krontep Mahanakhon and Bangkok, the statement said. What some people may not know is that even the term used by Thais to describe the capital is a shortened version of the official name. That name, which has roots in the Pali and Sanskrit languages, stretches 168 letters. It is more of a phrase to describe the city than a traditional name. The Guinness World Records Organization lists Bangkok's extremely long official name as the world's longest place name. I'm Brian Lynn.
The world's largest igloo restaurant can be found in northern India, in the Jammu and Kashmir area. An igloo is a shelter that is usually round and is made of snow and ice. But the cafe will not be available for too much longer. The 40-seat business is expected to melt away sometime in March. Snowglue Cafe is owned and operated by the Hotel Kolahoy Green Heights. It is at the Himalayan Winter Sports Resort of Gulmarg, which is 50 kilometers southwest of Srinagar and 2,500 meters above sea level. Syed Wasim Shah is the creator of the cafe. He said an igloo village in Zermatt, Switzerland, that he visited a few years ago, helped him come up with the idea. Snowglue Cafe is 11.43 meters tall and 13.56 meters wide. That makes it larger than the current record holder. The Guinness Book of World Records publishes such records. The igloo listed by Guinness is found in Switzerland. It is 10.5 meters tall and 12.9 meters wide. Shaw told VOA, "We have already written to Guinness Book of World Records to certify our record, and they will do it in due course of time." The cafe has two areas. Coffee and small foods are served in one area. The other is for artwork. Shaw said, "It took us 64 days, precisely 1,700 man days, to complete. We started on the 3rd December and completed on the 4th of February. He added, "We employed all locals to construct it, and the snow art was all done by me." The cafe immediately became popular with visitors from the resort. Shaw said the business has 300 to 400 visitors every day. He said he is asking people to pay about $3 to enter the snowy structure to limit the number of people. One of those customers was Dr. Vaishnavi. She visited Kashmir for the first time from the eastern Indian state of Orissa. She ate there with her husband, Dr. Indrajit. Vaishnavi told VOA that she was interested in the idea behind the structure and liked the feeling inside the Snowglue Cafe. Visitors wear winter clothes and sit on sheepskin seats to stay warm. Hamid Masoodi runs the Hotel Kolahoy Green Heights. He said this is the second year that the hotel has had the Igloo Cafe. "It is only possible to have one during the winter season, from early December until about the middle of March." He said the hotel built one last year that could fit 16 people. He estimates this year's larger igloo could serve almost 20,000 visitors during a full season. Shaw, meanwhile, has bigger plans. He said the goal is to create a full-fledged igloo village next year. It would have places to sleep, along with the Snow Glue Cafe. I'm Gregory Stockel.
Consider a time that you answered the phone or made a phone call. What kinds of words did you use? What kinds of grammatical structures were important? In today's report, we will explore a point of grammar connected to phone calls. You will learn about some uses of modal verbs. We describe English verbs in terms of three ideas: tense, aspect, and modality. That might sound like a lot to think about, but here is a simple explanation. Tense has to do with time. For example, tense can show present and past actions. Time beyond the basic present or past is often expressed by adding helping verbs to the present or past verb forms. This is how we form the simple future and past perfect, for example. Aspect is another idea related to verbs. It shows if an action is completed or ongoing. This is one of the differences between the simple past and past progressive. Modality is used to express ideas such as possibility, ability, or necessity. We use modal verbs to help change the meaning of other verbs. Three modal verbs are especially useful when describing or making phone calls: will, can, and could. Let's explore each. Imagine you are sitting with family or friends. You hear the phone ring. You say, "I'll answer the phone." This is short for "I will answer the phone." The main verb is answer. In this sentence, the modal verb will expresses willingness. When a person says, "I'll answer the phone," they are suggesting that they are able to answer the phone and they want to answer the phone. Imagine the same situation that we just explored. You are sitting with family or friends. You hear the phone ring, and perhaps everyone looks around to see who is going to answer the phone. You say,
"I can answer the phone."
Once again, the main verb is answer. In this case, the modal can suggests ability. You are able to answer the phone. You may or may not want to answer the phone. Another modal is very important when making phone calls: could. One of its uses is to express a polite request or suggestion. If you would like to make it even more polite, you could also use the word please. If you heard the phone ringing and wanted to ask another person to answer it, you could say, "Could you answer the phone?" Or, "Could you please answer the phone?" Could also is useful when making phone calls. Imagine you call your doctor's office. A person answers the phone. You might ask,
"Could I speak to Dr. Smith?"
Or,
"Could I please speak to Dr. Smith?"
If Dr. Smith worked at a large organization that has many offices, you might ask, could you transfer me to Dr. Smith's office? Or, could you please transfer me to Dr. Smith's office? The modal could is important in all these cases. If you said, I want to talk to Dr. Smith, or can I talk to Dr. Smith? Your message would be understood, but the person listening to you might think you were too direct, familiar, or demanding. In other words, they might think you are being rude. Today's program explored the use of modal verbs in phone calls. The next time you make a call, consider what terms and grammatical structures you use in your native language. Then compare it to the kinds of terms and structures you hear in English. Write down what you learn. And, as always, be sure to watch American films and listen to radio broadcasts in English. Pay careful attention to the modals and other kinds of vocabulary that you hear. I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal policies during the 1930s changed the face of American government. The new president and the Congress passed legislation that helped farmers, strengthened the banking system, and supplied jobs for millions of workers. One of the results of Roosevelt's policies was a stronger movement of organized labor in America. Sarah Long and Doug Johnson continue the story of the presidency of Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal policies during the 1930s changed the face of American government. The new president and the Congress passed legislation that helped farmers, strengthened the banking system, and supplied jobs for millions of workers. One of the most important results of Roosevelt's policies was a stronger American labor movement.
Labor leaders had little success in organizing workers in the United States during the 1920s. Three Republican presidents and a national wave of conservatism prevented them from gaining many members or increasing their negotiating power. In 1929, organized labor fell even further with the beginning of the Great Economic Depression. By 1933, America's labor unions had less than 3 million members. But by the end of the 1930s, more than 10.5 million American workers belonged to unions.
New laws proposed by the Roosevelt administration made the labor growth possible. The National Industrial Recovery Act of 1933 gave labor leaders the right to organize and represent workers. The Supreme Court ruled that the law was illegal. But another law, the Wagner Labor Relations Act of 1935, helped labor unions to increase their power. Most of the leaders of America's traditional labor unions were slow to understand their new power. They were conservative men. They represented workers with certain skills, such as woodworkers or metal workers. They did little to organize workers with other kinds of skills. But a new group of labor leaders used the new laws to organize unions by industries, not by skills. They believed that workers would have much more power if they joined forces with other workers in the same factory to make common demands. These new leaders began to organize unions for the automobile industry, the steel industry, and other major industries.
The leader of the new movement was the head of the mine workers, John L. Lewis. Lewis was a powerful leader with a strong body and strong opinions. He had begun to work in the coal mines at the age of 12. Lewis rose to become a powerful and successful leader of the mine workers, but he was concerned about workers in other industries as well, and he believed that most of the leaders in the American Federation of Labor were doing little to help them. For this reason, Lewis and the heads of several other unions formed their own group to organize unions by industry, not by skills. They called their group the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO, and they tried immediately to gain members.
The CIO successfully organized the workers in several major industries, but it succeeded only by hard work and struggle. The CIO's first big battle was against the giant automobile company, General Motors. Late in 1935, workers at several General Motors factories began a sit-down strike at their machines to demand better pay and working conditions. After 45 days, General Motors surrendered. It recognized that the Automobile Workers Union had the right to represent GM workers, and it agreed to negotiate a new work agreement.
The struggle at the Ford Motor Company was more bitter. Ford Company guards beat union organizers and workers. But the Ford Company finally agreed to negotiate with the new union. The same story was true in the steel industry. But the new labor leaders succeeded in becoming the official representatives of steel workers throughout the country. By 1938, the CIO had won its battle to organize major industries. In later years, it would join with the more traditional American Federation of Labor to form the organization that remains the most important labor group in America today, the AFL-CIO.
President Roosevelt was not always an active supporter of organized labor, but neither was he a constant supporter of big business, like the three Republican presidents before him. In fact, Roosevelt spoke out often against the dangers of big business in a democracy. These speeches caused great concern among many of the traditional business and conservative leaders of the nation. And Roosevelt's increasingly progressive policies in 1935 made many richer Americans fear that the president was a socialist, a dictator, or a madman. Former President Herbert Hoover, for example, denounced Roosevelt's New Deal policies as an attack on the whole idea of individual freedoms. The family of business leader J.P. Morgan told visitors not to say Roosevelt's name in front of Morgan. They said it would make his blood pressure go up.
This conservative opposition to Roosevelt grew steadily throughout 1935 and 36, Many Americans were honestly worried that Roosevelt's expansion of government was the first step to dictatorship. They feared that Roosevelt and the Democrats were trying to gain power as the Nazis did in Germany, the fascists in Italy, or the communists in Russia.
The Republican Party held its presidential convention in the summer of 1936. The party delegates chose Alfred Landon to oppose Roosevelt for president. Mr. Landon was the governor of the farm state of Kansas. He was a successful oil producer with conservative business views. But he was open to some of the social reforms of Roosevelt's New Deal. Republicans hoped he would appeal to average Americans who supported mild reforms, but feared Roosevelt's social policies. The Democrats nominated Roosevelt and Vice President John Garner to serve a second term.
The main issue in the presidential campaign of 1936 was Franklin Roosevelt himself. Roosevelt campaigned across the country like a man sure that he would win. He laughed with the cheering crowds and told them that the New Deal had helped improve their lives. In New York, Roosevelt made a major speech promising to continue the work of his administration if he was reelected.
Of course, we will continue to seek to improve working conditions for the workers of America. Of course, we will continue to work for cheaper electricity in the homes and on the farms of America. For better and cheaper transportation, for low interest rates, for sounder home financing, for better banking, for the regulation of security issues, for reciprocal trade among nations, and my friends, for all of these, we have only just begun to fight.
The Republican candidate, Alfred Landon, began his campaign by saying that many of Roosevelt's New Deal programs were good. But he said that a Republican administration could do them better and for less money. However, Landon's words became much stronger as the campaign continued. He attacked many of Roosevelt's programs. The campaign became increasingly bitter. Roosevelt said his opponents cared only about their money, not about other Americans. "I welcome their hatred," he said. Landon's supporters accused Roosevelt of destroying the nation's economic traditions and threatening democracy.
The nation had not seen such a fierce campaign in 40 years. But when it was over, the nation also saw a victory greater than any in its history. Franklin Roosevelt defeated Alfred Landon in the election of 1936 by one of the largest votes in the nation's history. Roosevelt won every state except Maine and Vermont. The huge election victory marked the high point of Roosevelt's popularity. In our next program, we will look at the many problems he faced in his second administration.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.